Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here today for episode number 442. In just a moment, I'll be sharing my conversation with Johanna Lunn. Johanna is a director and filmmaker and the creator of the When You Die Project. And we're going to be talking about that project, but also about her trilogy of documentary films that deal with death, dying, and the afterlife. And I wanted to let you know that the third film in her series, which is titled Architecture of Death, The Inner World of Dying, is being released on February 24th. So if you're listening near the broadcast date for this episode, you'll be able to join into that premiere if you're interested. And you can get a ticket for just $20, and it will include a live Q&A session with William Peters and hospice nurse Julie. The premiere is, again, February 24th, 2024 at 6 p.m. Eastern, and I really encourage you to join it. It sounds like it will be great. The film is wonderful. I can't say enough good things about it. And then also to be part of the Q&A session with William Peters and hospice nurse Julie, I think that will be fantastic. And I believe Johanna Lunn will be there as well for the premiere. So if you go to the show notes for this episode at eolupodcast.com, you'll find a link to purchase a ticket to go to the premiere for Architecture of Death. And I hope you'll do that. It's going to be fantastic. Next, I'd like to thank my latest supporters on my Patreon page at patreon.com/EOLU, and also remind everyone listening that there are some new bonuses available on that page for anyone who signs up. Once a month, you'll be able to get a little recording called What to Watch, where I make suggestions for some of the really death literate, death aware content that's present nowadays on television, on streaming channels or network channels in the as series or documentary films or other shows and films. And so I'm hoping that you'll listen to that and get some ideas and spend a little time every month watching some of this content so that we can show the creators and producers of death-friendly content that there is an audience for it out here. There are people who will watch and listen, and they'll keep making programming like that. So that's one of the bonuses on Patreon. The other are some short little bonus episodes from the interviews that I do, and there will be one today, very brief, just an extra little clip of my conversation with Johanna. So if you're on my Patreon page already, you'll be able to hear that little clip as well on Patreon. So my newest supporters are Jane Whitlock, Robin Maller, Carla Wheeler, and For Bridget. Thanks so much for joining the community on the Patreon page. And I also want to thank Dana Tuttle for buying me 3 coffees. Thank you, Dana, for keeping me supplied with the coffee that I love so much. And Lisa Creedon for joining the $10 for 10 years campaign. I just want to thank you all so very much, along with everyone else who's been making donations for the last few years. It really makes a big difference to me. So now we'll move on with my conversation with Johanna Lunn, and stay tuned afterwards for a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so happy to welcome my guest, Johanna Lunn, who is an award-winning producer, director, and writer who has crafted thought-provoking programs during her 20 years in the business. She has won 3 Gemini Awards, which is the Canadian equivalent of an Emmy, and has had 8 nominations for the Gemini Award. In addition to producing more than 150 hours of television series and one-offs as an in-house executive producer, she has made independent documentaries for her own companies, Wild East Productions and Center East Media, and won Best Documentary at Hot Docs International Film Festival for her moving and timely film, forgiveness stories for our time. And I'd love to discuss that sometime in the future, because that sounds amazing as well. She is also the director and producer of the When You Die documentary trilogy, which we'll be discussing today. And you can learn more about Johanna's work on the When You Die project at whenyoudie.org. So Johanna, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me today.
No, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to have this conversation.
Well, I've spent some time watching the films, the When You Die trilogy, and it's absolutely amazing. I was so moved and touched by it. And so I've been really excited ever since I watched them to be able to talk with you about it. But I thought maybe we'd start by having you just share a little bit more of your story, because not every filmmaker is drawn to make films that talk about when you die. And so I'd love to hear kind of what brought you to this place.
It's a long story. I'll try not to make it too long, though. I should say it's long in terms of the history of its origins, really. It really comes from my own very complex grief journey at a young age. So when I was 19, my mother died. And then in a 3-year period, my mother, my best friend growing up, and an old dairy farmer died in my arms. So three really unexpected, shocking deaths in a very short period of time. And at a time when death was truly, truly, truly taboo. And to be in a grief state was really to be an outcast. You know, people had no idea what to do with me. And my grief was just compounded and compounded again, you know, and then compounded again in such a short period of time and at such a young age that it was very difficult for me to integrate, especially since no one wanted to talk to me. And I didn't know how to interact with the world at all either. So it was a very confusing time. And I was in college, and that was also made it even more confusing, because it's at a time when you're really moving from childhood into some kind of adulthood and all of those things. And so it was a very difficult, difficult period for me. And my first job out of college was working as a research assistant for a project that PBS wanted to see a proposal for. At this time, I was living in the U.S. And it was on death and dying in the context of community. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work was extremely well known at that time. Stephen Levine and his wife's work was definitely out there. And the AIDS epidemic was happening, but not really publicized. So hospices were really starting. And I had a chance to interview a lot of really, really amazing people. And it was definitely helpful for me to start seeing a healthy way of integrating all of the trauma that I experienced at a young age. We put together a proposal. It was amazing by PBS's account. They said, "We've never seen anything like this. This is really important information." But they said, "It's really still too taboo. We don't feel like we can touch this right now." And so that was the beginning of my career. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was too bad, but, you know, moved on and did other things and was, you know, I had a career. I moved to Canada, where most of my adult life has been spent here, and working in film and television. And I had many roles working in television, programming film festivals, you know, and then I started my own production company and did a number of films. And then I reached a point where I'd finished one, and my business partner and I looked at each other. It was like, "Well, what's next?" And I'm the creative one, you know, and I'm like, "Well, you know, we could do this, or we could do this," or, you know, no, none of it was landing. And I also have a mentor who's been very, very helpful to me throughout my career. And she sat with me for a while and went through my list. And she said, "I know you have something else." I said, "Well, there's this project that never got made. It was around death and dying. And she said, that's it. That's what you have to do. So I thought, okay, I really committed to doing it. But as someone who's worked in television, I know that when you pitch a project to a broadcaster or a major funder, they really want to have control over the story for the most part. They really want to have a hand in it. And at that point, I didn't really know what the story was. I wanted to research widely and talk to a lot of people because I felt that I didn't know, that I didn't really know this thing about death and dying. What is it in community? What happens to people? What happens to your mind? So the whole thing, your emotional state, your spiritual state, your physical state, the community and family around you, I didn't know. And so I did it the hard way. I didn't get the funding for it up front. I did just the opposite of how you're supposed to make movies. You're supposed to come in, know what you're shooting, and then coax people into saying what you want them to say. And I didn't do it that way at all. So that meant that over a long period of time, I was filming interviews based on where our other paying gigs took us. So if I was going to London, England, it would be like, well, who's in England or any country nearby that I want to talk to? Or if I'm on the West Coast, who's out here? Because I would have a whole crew with me that I, would not have to cover the travel expenses or hotels for. I could just pay them a little bit for the shoot. Although just about everybody unanimously did it for free because everyone was behind this project on my team. And so that is how it started getting cobbled together. And I did a lot of research. So I had like big binders full of, people I would love to interview. I mean, like over 100 people.
Wow.
And so obviously that wasn't going to happen. And once we got up to about the number 19 interview, my business partner said to me, I think we have to make the movie now. And in the meantime, I'd started a website because I had all this resource information and I wanted people to have access to it because I thought it was important. And I was like, oh no, we need just a couple more. And then COVID hit and it was like, okay, we have to edit these films. We've got to really do this now. And I had already been sort of rough editing and knew what I had. And but it was really clear that it wasn't one movie. I mean, normally an independent documentary would be maybe 3 years. You research it, you shoot it, you edit it, you get it out in the world, and then you're on to the next one. Well, this has really been a 10-year project. And we're only just now launching the third in what became a trilogy of films. So it was really a project born out of my own personal grief journey and out of an intense love and desire for all of us to understand this incredibly important passage of a human life. What's it about?
Wow.
That's where it comes from.
It's a great story. Well, I love on the one hand that it was like a side project for a while to do the interviews, but it seemed like it was all somehow perfectly orchestrated. The right people were happened to be wherever you were traveling because you captured such wonderful speakers. But then it also occurs to me how those of us who have experienced or dealt with death and dying and grief, we understand what a treasure this information is, this wisdom and this knowledge. And yet you have to go up against people in the outside world who don't know that, who are telling you, oh no, that would never be a good subject. Oh no, that wouldn't be the right direction to go. Because that happens in publishing or used to all the time for authors as well, just getting shut down because the people who run those businesses and industries haven't had their own experience and don't understand how valuable the information is.
That's so true. And I think the other side of it too is often if you're a publisher or you're a broadcaster or a programmer of one of the streams, you're always looking in the rearview mirror for what was working. Where were you getting your biggest audiences or sales or whatever? And it never works that way because we are never going backwards as a society and a culture. We're going forward. So it's a brave person who would commission a film on death and dying, because there isn't a lot of success stories.
Yeah, so very true. Yeah, if we look backwards, all we see is the taboo and the stigma around talking about death. But that perspective just continues to foster the taboo and our lack of discussion about it. So I applaud your bravery to step forward and create this project.
Well, thank you. It definitely took a little village and, a great business partner who just, rooted me on. I think that everywhere I went, I was encouraged. I think that when I started, there wasn't it was a way ahead of its time. And at this point, I feel like the films are really in the right time, in the right place. I think if I'd finished it 8 years ago or even 7 years ago, that it would probably not go as far. There wouldn't be as much interest. But I think we've been through and are going through a lot as a culture right now, like enormous losses. If COVID didn't, bring up the subject of death and dying, the environment does, the economy does. I mean, there's so many grief streams that are happening right now and losses that it's interesting to me how many people in their 30s and 40s are really interested in this subject right now. Whereas you would never have thought that age group was a prime target for death and dying. It'd be like, well, 55 up, maybe more like 60, but not younger people who are really entering into their careers and beginning really to make their mark in a lot of ways. So I think we're just in a time right now where we really need this conversation and we really need to understand what it means to be human.
It's so true, and I personally feel that we really need media, we need films and documentaries that teach people, because I think it gives such great access to this information to such a big group of people who low cost can watch a film. They can come with all their questions and doubts and fears and sit and watch a film and be transformed by it over the period of an hour or so. And I think that's really powerful.
I think it's really great when people can watch films together and have conversations. And that certainly was forefront in my mind making these films, which maybe I should say a little bit about what the trilogy, what the films are.
Yes.
The first one is In the Realm of Death and Dreaming. And it really explores the question of, does consciousness continue after death or is it lights out? What are personal stories of things like near-death experiences or deathbed experiences, visitations, dreams, all those things? What some of the science has to say right now around consciousness studies? Because in the scientific community, this is a big emerging field. I mean, it's been gaining a lot of momentum over the last decade, and they're going places with this question. But I will say, on the science side, there is no definitive proof that consciousness ends at death, and there is no definitive proof that it continues. So the thing I love about that is it remains a great mystery. So we can all kind of wade around in it. And so this film is really exploring that territory. I never in any of these films or anywhere in the When You Die Project tell people what to think. I really try to give people different things to think about and to ask and to reflect on in their own life and with their own set of values. Because there isn't a definitive answer. It's more what it feels right for you. So if you don't believe that consciousness continues, there is nothing wrong with that point of view. It means that right now is the most important moment in our life, which, quite frankly, is where our attention should be right now.
Exactly.
But I still think people should consider what they want when they die. And I think that question about what happens when we die and does consciousness continue helps to inform us what we might want as we, if we get a prognosis, a terminal prognosis, or we're aging out, what's going on there? What would you like as you're going through that process? So that's the first film. The second film, Saying Goodbye, Preparing for Death, it's a lot about how to talk about death, how to have the conversation. There are certain, things thrown in there that you might not have thought about, what you might want as you're dying or preparing for your death. So just, again, it's not a definite, none of these are definitive. They're really, really meant to, in a way, almost walk away with more questions than you ever knew you had about death and dying. So the second film is really opening up that conversation, and I hope in a loving way, in a kind way, in a gentle way, and to alleviate fear. All three films are really address the issue of fear and how we can make friends with this short life, and death. So then the third film is The Architecture of Death, The Inner World of Dying. And that really is the spiritual, emotional, and physical what happens when you die in the weeks and days and moments leading up to death and a little bit after. So that's the trilogy. Anyway, that's where we're at with the trilogy.
It's really beautiful, and I love the way that you've divided it into these three different subject matters, really, because I think that's a great way to approach death and dying anyway. And sometimes we have to think about different aspects of it because it's a little too much for us to grasp all of it at once. And I did want to say the speakers that you've interviewed, all of them have such a calming presence, and that comes through loud and clear. And so I think the films indeed really do help with fear. It really helps you contemplate things that to the mind are frightening, and yet you have guides through it, talking you through it and talking about ways to look at it that really alleviate the fear.
Yeah, I really feel very fortunate to have talked to so many amazing people. Each person who's featured in these films is deeply, deeply steeped in their disciplines, and they're wise, they're boots on the ground, wise people. And that's another thing I think a lot of people would say, well, did you follow someone who was dying during the course of your filming? And it's like, no, I didn't. I actually did not want to do that. There are many very beautiful films that do that, and they're so helpful. But I really wanted to talk to people who have spent their careers exploring what happens when you die and being at the bedside, and real seasoned people that had a lot of knowledge that they were very, very happy to share and share generously.
Yeah, one there was a line from the film, and I'm not sure who said it. I think it was from the third one, that I wrote down to remember. The ego and mind don't know how to die, but the body does. And that really, that's why we need this kind of training for the mind and the ego, which become the obstacles to having a peaceful death and peace of mind and quality of life. Because it's our mind and ego that needs the training. The body already knows how to die and will die. That will happen for us. We just want to remove the obstacles that the mind creates, that cause us to fear death and dying.
I loved that too. That was Amrish Ahsan, and That I agree with you. I thought it was a real game changer to say it like that, because I was, I'd been going along knowing that, learning about how the body knows how to die. And she just was so brilliant to say, well, yeah, of course the body does know how, but here's where the problem is. And it really is the fear issue. It because we don't know what we don't know, right? I mean, Andrew Holacek said that quite beautifully, that we are most afraid of the thing that we don't know, and we don't know about death. And I think that that's really true, that you kind of have to calm down your nervous system, which the ego really has a grip on, the fight or flight thing. And if you can reason with that and feel safe and say, hey, you got this. Your body knows how to do this. It's natural to it. And that the more you try to intervene with well-meaning intention, the more suffering you're going to have. And I thought that was really an amazing discovery. For me, that was a real discovery. I kind of sensed that we've been dying for centuries, so our bodies must know how to do it. But I hadn't realized how much we're really at this crossroad in healthcare, where, and again, this is a point I really try to make in the films, where there's a time when the time for curing is done, the time for healing, which is a very different kind of work, begins, and it's a different team. So it takes the pressure off of doctors who are fabulous clinicians, technicians, and they know all the kind of plumbing stuff to do. But at a certain point, that isn't helpful anymore. And it can actually rob time from someone who's dying that they could spend in a totally different way, and that it would be a different way for every human being. It might be just eating ice cream, or spending more time with your family, or having people drive you, like we did with my father in the autumn. It was the October when he died, and he wanted to drive into the mountains and see the leaves turning. And that was a huge gift to him. But if we'd kept him in the hospital, that would not have been possible. So knowing that there is another team, and we're also at this time where that other team is really developing, that it's not just hospices, but I mean, palliative care has become such a sophisticated field. People shouldn't die in pain. We have knowledge that can really help with that. Just like there are people that are trained in helping making meaning at end of life and going through your life. What a gift that is to have someone skilled to do that. Because left to our own devices, a lot of us wouldn't know how to make sense of it all, but with a nice guide who can help us making meaning and recognizing this has been a rich life. It's sort of like covering all the bases of not feeling, working through whatever guilt or unresolved stuff. We could do that. That's why it's a healing time, and I, again, it was really Amory Chasson who talked about, wouldn't it be great if we called it, I'm going to go into my healing period now.
Wow.
I mean,
I
it's like,
love that. And I love the idea that it's another team. We need to bring in a new team when we shift the direction of our focus from trying to cure something to that healing phase. And like you said, instead of berating all the physicians who trained in order to focus on curing, let them do what they do. They're good at that. And
yeah.
let's not try to remake them and ask them to also be the healing team, because that just may not be part of their skill set. And we have all these people ready and willing to be on the healing team. So let's just get more comfortable shifting from one team to the other, and knowing when it's the right time for that.
Yeah, and I think doing it with a lot of gratitude too, because our curing team, they work so hard, and I think that we're more broadly aware now the kind of strain that the healthcare system is under and how understaffed people are and the demand is growing and all of that. And I think we really need to have a lot more compassion for our healthcare providers.
Yeah, that's so very true. And in fact, our healthcare providers actually benefit when there's the healing team around. I was reading a study about that when a palliative care team comes into a hospital environment, it actually helps the mental and emotional health of all the staff in the hospital because of just that, the mindset, and because there are people holding space that healing is possible, and we know what it takes and what to do to help move in that direction. And I think it just adds an element to the care being offered there that wasn't there before in the past.
Oh, I love that. That makes so much sense to me.
Yeah, because all of us need that healing approach, and it's just because medicine has left it out for such a long time that healthcare providers don't even know how to do that for themselves.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. I mean, I think that's a huge area too, right? That it's to my knowledge, and I know you probably know so much more about this, but I don't think that self-care is really taught in medical school.
No, in fact, when I went through medical school, it's almost like, how do I say it? You get awarded points for how little sleep you can get by on. Oh, if you're the person who didn't sleep for 36 hours but kept going and worked really hard, you go up in status in other people's minds, and never stopping to think like that's horrible. That's so destructive. And we're praising people for that instead of offering to help them out or offering suggestions for here's something you might need to preserve your own health.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think the more widely that people understand all of these things that we're talking about, that it will create change. People often say, well, how are you going to change things? How are you going to change things? And it's really one person at a time. But you can reach a lot of people. You can really reach a lot of people, the work that you're doing, and so many other people who are in deaf education. We need to reach a broader audience so that they can know that they should ask their doctor, are they okay? Or, are you okay? Have you had enough sleep? Do you like sushi? I don't know.
have your films been, do you know if they're being used at all in medical training institutions?
Yeah, that's really a big target audience for me. And now that the third film is about to be released, so the first two are out and people can watch them on our website, whenyoudie.org. Very inexpensive rental, available to everyone. The third one, it's interesting because this one has actually been ready for quite a while. I mean, not a whole year, but pretty long time. And I'm really glad that I held it back. I did some sneak preview screenings among some medical people. I did a big conference, the International Conference on University Educators Who Teach Deaf and Culture. That was a really big audience. But I held it back. I wasn't ready to release it. And everybody on my team was like, what is wrong with you? Like, let's get it out there. It's done. It's ready. It's blah, blah, blah. But I don't know why I didn't. I mean, I didn't do anything in a normal way with this project. So I don't know why I should start now. My intuition really said no. And then I realized, the time is now right. So at the end of February, we'll be releasing the film. We'll have a big release event on the 24th. And I'm really looking forward to that. So this third film has been ready, but not ready. And so now that all three will be ready, we can really start selling. You know, we've already sold individually to university medical schools and also in the sociology departments for death and culture kind of issues. A lot of hospices are picking it up for their staff as well as for their families, which is really, really great. We are getting interest in bereavement groups, smaller ARP groups in the US. American Association of Retired Persons have a number of chapters, state chapters, and they're doing movie nights, which is helpful for their constituents. And so we are definitely doing that. But now with the third one, we will do a much more concerted sort of push to sell them all together. I mean, they certainly each one stands alone. But I don't know, and I'd love your thought on this, but I feel like they were meant to all come together.
Yeah, I was going to say that very thing that it, watching them, each one does stand alone, but looking back on the whole of all three, you're right. They each cover something different and it's all essential, all really important. So I love the idea of the trilogy, but also I love the idea of a movie night because since each film, are they each around an hour? That's what it seemed to me, about an hour long, which is perfect because you can show the film and then have a disc, there's time to have a discussion afterwards. And they're very thought-provoking. And so I would imagine that really rich conversations take place with from people who have watched one of the films.
Yeah, I mean, I did that on purpose, making them under an hour because I really wanted, to me, all the films I've ever made, having conversations about what you think, what these subjects are about. To me, that's the most generative possible biggest gift to me as a filmmaker is when people can say, you know, we watched these and we talked for 2 hours, and you go, wow, that is so great. You know, please share it. Yeah.
It's fantastic. Like I could even see it for a family movie night, when you get all your extended family together and everyone watches one of the films, and that leads into even a discussion of our own end of life plans and what we're thinking. But I was wondering, do you have any kind of like facilitators, guides, or anything that might go with the movies if someone did want to do use it in that way?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Each film does have a guide that goes with it, and it's everything from how to set up an event to screen, questions, how to advertise, posters, all of that stuff. So it's a complete package. But particularly, I think, I mean, and people have found all of those things helpful. Even though we have a list of questions for each film to generate conversation, I'm not sure anyone's ever had to use that list. But all the how-tos and back more background on the speakers who are in the films and little more background on, you know, why these films were made and all of that. So I know that the guides are very, very helpful.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. And I wanted to say, I trust your intuition about the timing because it seems like this whole project, as you said, it's kind of come together in this sort of magical, divine way. And that I think it's really important to wait for the right timing because, as you saw, that initial project back in the past didn't fly because it wasn't time yet. And so yeah, I trust whatever intuitive guidance you've had, I think is probably just right. But I would love to see every community have a film night or as part of some sort of festival going on in the community, a film night and show these films because they're what do I want to say? They're very approachable for the average person, it seems to me, in terms of you don't have to already know very anything about death and dying, and you don't have to know medical terms or jargon, and you can come in as someone, completely uninformed in a way about end of life situations and still get so much out of the films.
Yeah, that's great. I really had that audience in mind making them. That it's not for the, you know, highly educated end of life person. It's from my brothers, you know, who don't know anything and don't really want to talk about it. But of course, I've forced them to.
Of course.
But they still have their own opinions and they have their own, you know, but yeah, I wanted it to be really approachable.
Yeah, that's a good word for it, because they definitely are. So I'm saying it because I want to encourage people listening. Like, if you're trying to think of something you could do in your community to foster more conversations about the end of life, like this film series would be a fantastic thing to offer. And so how would one go about if they wanted, say, to do a neighborhood film series? How do they go about accessing each one of the films to do that?
On our website, I think that you'll see people who want to do that can reach out to, I believe it's programs@whenyoudie.org. We'll give you all the help and whatever that you need. I mean, we definitely are there to help people do exactly this.
Oh, that's perfect. So, it's a if someone just has the inspiration to do it, they can get all the guidance they need from you. So it shouldn't be that much that they them you know that they have to take on, that they without knowing how to do it, they can find
No,
everything
that's
they
right.
need from
That's
you.
right. Yeah.
Yeah,
A to Z, we got your back.
I'd love to see that happen, because we're at the point right now and we're training lots of death doulas, and we're developing lots of tools and resources, and we have lots of people out there who want to help. But if we don't educate the masses, we won't have enough people ready yet to utilize the services. And so that's where I feel like that's our step right now. We've got to keep educating the general public and helping them get over their fear, as these films do, so that they could actually talk to someone about moving into that healing phase.
Yeah, that's well said. I support that.
Yeah, so in my opinion, the films are coming out at exactly the right time when they could make a really big impact in our communities. I know the website, you have a website that offers other things. You have podcasts and a place for stories. And so I wanted you to talk a little bit about that as well.
Sure. Well, I think as I mentioned that in the beginning, as I was researching and learning, I mean, I'm still learning. There's so much to learn. I was putting things up on a website. So that's a lot of things that are in our resource section on the website, and there are a lot of resources there. And I always welcome people who, if they have other things that should be there in those resource pages, to please, please let us know, because we will just add them, because that's what we want to do. They're not so much country or province or state specific. It tends to be more broad than that, because if we start to get into wills and medical directives for every state in the United States, every province in Canada, every province in Australia, it gets to be, that's not our job. But there's tons and tons of other kinds of books and other organizations and all kinds of stuff. There are stories. Some of these are just things that have been in other publications that we've reprinted or pointed to. And again, there are just more and more and more wonderful, interesting, provocative stories that are getting out into the public. So we do welcome ideas around that as well. And the podcasts are there. We also have a YouTube channel that really just got up over Christmas that has all of our podcasts and some other shorts and extras. There are also other shorts, videos that are on our website as well. There's just a lot of stuff there. You could spend a couple days.
Yeah,
Or
so
if you've only got 5 minutes, just to peruse it a little bit.
Yeah, it's worth visiting because you can scroll through those stories and you'll see the title of one and think, "Oh, that's exactly what I need to read today, that particular story." So, it's a very helpful website. So, I encourage people to go there. And then I wanted to ask you a little more personally, in the process of doing these films, what have you learned? Did you find answers to some of your own questions or healing for your own grief? I'm just curious about how that process has been for you.
Well, I don't think that at this point I was carrying a lot of grief, unprocessed grief when I started this project 10 years ago. I had worked through an awful lot of stuff. But I think that there's so many facets to immersing myself in all things end of life. One thing definitely happened was that I am not afraid of dying. I don't want to leave, and I think that leaving is hard because I love so many people, my own family and so on. So I know that the leaving part is hard, but I'm not afraid of death. I truly am not. So that certainly is a big gift. And also, I think I got a huge gift in discovering that people have extraordinary perception, sense perception abilities that we just don't use. Because at end of life, all kinds of things, as your consciousness begins to expand and sort of detach from the body. You're much more sensitive to all types of experiences. And if your loved ones are also sensitive, then you get into things like premonitions of your loved one dying. I had that experience when I was very young of my great aunt. I knew the moment she died. I don't know how I knew that, but I did. I knew it. And that's a very common thing, or that people who are dying have deathbed visitations, or that shared death experiences happen, and this is where people who are not dying journey with the person who's dying as they are leaving their body, as they are leaving, passing on to something else. So there's a huge range of perceptual abilities that humans have. And it's not just around death. I mean, we've all heard of, mystical experiences, spiritually transformative experiences, and those seem to be the very rare spiritual masters, the Thomas Mertons, these great yogis have these experiences. But, I also discovered that happens to housewives in Kansas, and very, very common things will happen to people that we don't talk about. And I think that once you get into the end of life, exploration, you discover that people have out of body experiences, and football players have out of body experiences when they're whacked at full speed in the middle of a tackle. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because these are like the people you would least expect to have an out-of-body experience. And yet, a lot of athletes in rough and tumble sports do experience that. So I it just made me realize that there is a whole range of, we could call them spiritual experiences, but I think they have to do with our sense perceptions, these things that we haven't truly explored very much. It's kind of in the realm of yogis and mystics, but actually it turns out to be far more ordinary. And I think that was the other thing that all of these deathbed experiences and sensitivities and moments with your loved one that are heightened presence of now, that these are very, very common and very human and very ordinary. And so to me, discovering that there's so much more to being a person, to being a human, this was like the biggest gift in the entire world to go, wow. we really are special.
Yeah.
Every one of us.
Yeah, those stories were so inspiring, hearing those stories and hearing what's possible. And as you said, possible for anyone. And even sometimes for people who'd never explored spirituality, never had anything close to a spiritual experience any other time in their lives, and yet were having these amazing, phenomenal experiences at the very end of life. And it comes from that, what you alluded to at the beginning, the mystery. We still don't know. We don't know, does consciousness persist after we die or not? We don't know, but there's a mystery surrounding the last moments of life and what happens after death. And there's just so much for each one of us to learn and to see within it. And it's really beautiful. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that the films explore so well, the mystery of it, without, as you said, not leading anyone to any kind of answer, only leaving it there as a mystery that each one of us in our own way, on our own journey, will delve into that mystery ourselves.
Yeah. And, I think the ordinariness of it is important too. That you don't have to be an extraordinary anything. That could be your hairdresser, could be person selling you groceries, that it's just part of our humanity.
Yes, exactly. And so, yeah, not special, not reserved for any one group of people or another, something that's there for everyone. And it's really beautiful. I did really enjoy hearing the stories that everyone shared about people they had worked with.
Yeah, me too. And I would say, I guess I was in the very beginning, I was somewhat surprised by how common, these stories of, deathbed visitations or dreams. So someone's dying and their dead Uncle Harry comes and is talking to them, and no one else in the room can see it, but the person who's dying, it can. And that these events, like deathbed dreams, are incredibly helpful for the person who's dying. And I guess, part of my desire to make these stories ordinary is that instead of saying to your loved one, "Oh, no, that's just a hallucination," then you're negating something that's incredibly important to this person at this time, at the very end of their life. So even if you just think it's not true or a hallucination, why don't you say, "What did Uncle Harry say?" Or, "Was it a good visit?"
Exactly. Just be curious.
Yeah, and validate it. Just validate it. It doesn't take much. And I think sometimes that people negate these experiences because they're afraid of them, that it seems too far out there, which is why I think that I like to come back to the fact that it's ordinary and common to have these experiences, so that we can be comfortable with them and to get curious about them too. Because when people are dying, we need to validate their experience. We're not there to have, the last argument.
Yeah, so true. And there may be people who don't even share their experiences because they themselves aren't sure. Is it okay? This is happening, but what will others think if I tell them this happened? And they may keep it to themselves. So they may be so much more common than we even know.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think certainly for my parents' generation, they did not talk about these things. Although for my grandmother, who was born in the early 1890s, who was born in the family homestead, 12 kids survived. I think my great-grandmother birthed a whole lot more than that. So a lot of babies died in that house. And a lot of people grew old and died, like my great grandparents. And the house even had, well, it had a parlor because they didn't have living rooms yet. That was a later World War II, post-World War II invention. But in the parlor was a little door down on the floor. And I sort of had the thought when I was younger that it was for wood, to easy way to put wood in the house. But then I realized when I was a teenager, there's no wood stove here. And so I said to my grandmother, I said, "Granny, what is that door for?" And she said, "Oh, that's where the dead people go feet first." I was like, "You mean it was built for that?" It was purpose built for death. The house had a door where the dead bodies left the house because in that Victorian period, dead people don't go out the front door. That's a very not so good thing. So you could come in and out if you're alive, but when you die and you die in the house because people were born in the house and they died in the house, they had their own exit, their own door. And so I know in her generation, they knew the language of death. They knew about all of these things. It was happening right there. But somehow in that next generation, the modern generation that moved into, the industrial world and, really greening America and building great nations and saving the world and all of that, that in that generation, it was a real buck up. You can't be weak. It's all about material. The material world was really ushered in with that generation. So, it pushed away anything that was soft or perceptual or, regarded as a weakness. Emotional things were kind of put aside for this greater thing. And then that, of course, coupled with the fact that certainly all the World War II vets, had post-traumatic shock and they just wanted to drink everything away and forget about death and dying. And that's where the living room came into play. So we don't have dead people in the house anymore and all that stuff. So I feel like my parents' generation definitely didn't talk about any of these things. And now the boomer generation is much more like, "Well, yeah, I saw so and so doing that." They're much more willing to talk about it. And I think the generation after this, my daughter and her family, that that it'll be more normal for them. It'll be a lot more normal.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, I just when you were describing that door in the in your grandmother's house, I had this thought of like those old homes, how much death they have held, the walls and the windows and the floors. I mean, those houses have been kind of open arms in a way, wrapping around death and holding death in our modern homes. Well, many of them have had someone die in the home, but not in the same way as that, as over decades and decades of time, having many of the people who grew up and lived there also die within those walls.
Very different relationship than we have now.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Well, it's so much fun to talk to you. I feel like I could just keep talking and talking. I actually would love to sit down and watch each film with you and then have you do a narration over the film of, well, and tell me the backstories of of all the interviews and where you met that person. And I think that'd be really fascinating.
Oh, maybe sometime. Who knows?
Yeah, you'll do a narrated version of the films someday down the road. Well, I'll remind listeners to go to whenyoudie.org to look up the films, but also the stories that are posted there and the podcasts, and then to reach out. And I'm hoping people will feel inspired to have some sort of a film night or a film festival in their community, or at least watch the films themselves. But they really are meant to be shared, I think, with a larger group of people because, well, I watch them alone and then immediately I wished I had someone with me that I could just talk to about it. So share them with others.
And we're here to help if you do that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That I think that's very encouraging. It won't be that hard to put something together because you'll get resources and guidance to do it. Well, thanks again, Johanna, for coming and talking with me. I really appreciate it.
It's really a pleasure, Karen. Thank you so much. And I appreciate so much all that you're doing. Thank you very much.
You're so very welcome. It's my pleasure, and I love getting to meet people like you who are doing such good work in the world. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Johanna Lunn about the trilogy of films created for whenyoudie.org, and that you'll consider taking in that live premiere of the third film in the series, Architecture of Death, on February 24th. One thing that really stood out, there are a couple of things that stood out for me from our conversation. One was this idea that the body knows how to die, but the ego and mind don't. And that when we're doing death education with people, we're actually trying to help calm their fears and educate the mind and the ego so that they don't become obstacles to the body's natural innate knowledge of how and when to die. And I hadn't really looked at it that way before, but that's really intriguing to me. And I also really liked our talk about the fact that we need to think of our medical care as we near the end of life as two different teams. There's the curing team that is the most important at certain times in the trajectory of an illness, and the healing team that needs to take over when curing is no longer possible. And I also really like thinking of our end-of-life care in those terms and reassuring all the doctors who want to focus on curative care that it's fine for them to keep doing what they're good at and what they love. But they do need to acknowledge that there's also a healing team standing by who can take over when curing is no longer helping the patient. So those were just a couple of my favorite takeaways from the conversation. And again, I really encourage you to watch the films, attend the premiere on February 24th if you can. And if you're interested in joining the Patreon team or making another small contribution, say by buying me a coffee or donating on PayPal, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support and you'll find all three of those options for making a contribution. And I really appreciate it in advance if you choose to do that. Also, please be sure to share this podcast with other people who might benefit from listening in, and subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen. That's very helpful in terms of our algorithm and helping us to be shown to people who are searching for content like this. And thanks again for all of you who've left wonderful reviews. I really appreciate that. So I'll be back next week and I'll be featuring a conversation I had with Jeremy Holloway about a program he's created to tackle social isolation and loneliness for older adults. So you'll enjoy listening to that as well next week. And until then, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment of your very precious life. Bye-bye.